Years ago, as Americans became more mobile and radio went national, many pundits predicted that we would all start to sound the same in time. But as it turns out, that hasn't happened. On today's edition of Please Explain, we are taking a look at regional accents, where they come from, how they are changing in some cases, and joining us are Kara Becker of the Linguistics Department of New York University, and Natalie Schilling, Associate Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leonard. Hi.
Natalie, are dialects and accents the same thing?
Not exactly. There's overlap. An accent, first of all, refers to the pronunciation features that are associated with a dialect, whereas a dialect includes pronunciation features and also grammar features, so sentence structure features, dialect words, so the whole range of language, whereas an accent, again, is just the pronunciation.
So when we hear a person with a southern accent say, "Fixin' to, are you all?" We're not surprised. Or somebody from Appalachia saying, "I'm a comin'," we're also not surprised.
Right.
Kara, don't we find regional accents in most languages? Or can I say all languages?
You might say all, yeah. I think it's extremely common. Any language that's large enough or has enough speakers, you're always going to find variation within a group that's large enough to have variation, because that's just a sort of a fact of language. So, yes, absolutely.
So we should not be surprised that an American accent developed, although we have a language person who comes on our show regularly who claims that the American accent is closer to what the way the British sounded when they started coming to this country. They're the ones who've changed.
That's partly true, and it really depends on where in the U.S. you're looking. So here in New York and in other cities along the eastern seaboard, when immigrants were coming over from England, they were coming from the south of England, and they took with them a lot of those features that we actually carried on in a lot of these places. Later immigrants brought other features from England. So, if you settled in Philadelphia, you sounded quite different from someone who moved to New York. And a lot of those things from Philadelphia and those places moved westward. So it really depends on when, where. And I would say changes happen in both places.
And Natalie, we make all sorts of judgments based on the accents that we hear, don't we? Even from this people who come from the same area.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we make all sorts of judgments, not all of them positive, some of them positive. So, for example, I've done a lot of work with Southern dialects in the U.S., and we might make judgments of Southerners as sometimes, unfortunately, we might think, oh, that sounds slow or uneducated. At the same time, though, there's positive associations of hospitality, friendliness, these sorts of things. Conversely, maybe we're thinking more northern dialect, we might think, oh, that person is kind of abrupt and always in a rush, that kind of thing. But, maybe, oh, they're efficient, they're cosmopolitan, these sorts of things. Whether or not these judgments are fair, no, not really. So
New Yorkers who tend to live in a more high-pressured environment are likely to talk faster, maybe interrupt once in a while. And while we see this as just part of the friendly interaction between people, people in other parts of the country who used to a slower pace might see it as rude and a little too aggressive. You're nodding your head.
Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, sometimes it does link up with actual features, like you mentioned, speech rate or interruption or things like that. In other cases, really, what it is that we're linking language really to other kinds of social judgments, so that if we live outside of New York and we don't necessarily like New Yorkers for whatever reason, we may use their language as a reason to sort of point out what we don't like about them.
So we can stereotype based on that. But we also will notice even the subtlest differences. For example, there are a number of different Boston accents, and there's the genteel Kennedy Boston accent as opposed to the ward healer politician accent.
Sure.
And is even though they both grow out of Irish immigration.
Yes, I think so. I mean, a lot of that is a combination of a number of social characteristics that might affect the way one might adopt something that's regional about their speech. And you mentioned, you know, the Boston Brahmin being, you know, really associated with a higher class of folks living in Boston. And then you can kind of move down that social strata and look at different kinds of features that are used by perhaps working class speakers or something like that.
But that doesn't happen in New York for some reason.
It does, actually. I think that most of the features we associate with the New York accent are probably linked very closely to a more working class, lower middle class social strata, so that in my research, which looks at New York City dialect, what you see is that younger speakers and also people who are upwardly mobile or of a higher class status are really losing some of those features that we consider to be characteristic of New York City.
Natalie, we touched on this earlier, but have there always been distinct accents in America, in New England and the South, for example?
Yes, absolutely. So that the first English speakers who came to what was then, you know, the British colonies, or even before that time, in establishing the British colonies, yes, came from different areas of England, bringing their own accents, which were in place at the time in the British Isles. So ever since English came to the U.S., they brought with them their different dialects.
And then we had these waves of immigration. We had Germans,
right.
We had the Irish, we had Italians and
right.
Jews. Can we see the difference in different areas of the country?
Absolutely, yes, indeed. In fact, really one of the main characteristics that differentiates American English from British English is whether or not we pronounce certain R's, as in whether we say mother or father or car, or mother or father or car. And in American English, of course, we pronounce our R's typically, except for areas such as New York City, areas of the South.
Connecticut.
Areas, Connecticut, exactly.
The Waymet Buckley Sound.
Right. But whereas, so I guess, the typical norm in American English is to pronounce the R's, whereas the norm and the standard, the accepted standard in British English is not pronouncing the R's. So ca, father, that sort of thing. And one of the main reasons why we have so much more R pronunciation in the U.S. is because of the huge waves of immigration of people from Ireland and also Scots-Irish. And that has contributed a lot to what linguists sometimes refer to as the R-ful character of American English. Not to be confused with awful.
Now, what has determined the standard American accent? Is that just a kind of an evening out of all of the different accents?
Yeah, it's very difficult to pinpoint what counts as standard American English. We don't have one set rule book or language academy or something like this, such as they have in a country such as France. And so I think it varies. We tend to think of it as something that just kind of sounds neutral or accentless, like we can't place it somewhere. Sometimes we say, well, it's the language of the news media, something like this. Sometimes we say, well, it's something that's probably somewhere in the Midwest, something like this. It's a little difficult to pin down, and of course it changes over time. So,
well,
I'm
from Brooklyn.
Okay.
I don't know why I speak the way I do, and I'm not sure other people know why they speak the way they do. And I would think, Kara, in New York, that there are a wide range of accents even within the boroughs and in the adjoining areas.
Absolutely. And I think, you hit on an important point, which is that it really comes down in some cases to the level of the individual and people's personal motivations. So I mentioned class. So if you're upwardly mobile, you may be very motivated to lose some of your regional accents. You may want to speak more standardly. That would be common in the news media or something like that.
We have a clip of someone from Newark speaking.
Great.
I was born 44 years ago in Newark, New Jersey, exactly 1 mile from where I live right now. At age 26, I purchased a two-family home in Belleville, which is a suburb of Newark with about 35,000 residents. From any point in Belleville, one can clearly view the Manhattan skyline. We are only 5 miles west of Lower Manhattan.
Now, that was a relatively modulated accent, and yet you heard all sorts of the Manhattan.
Absolutely, yeah, the pronunciation of Manhattan especially, and there was some R-lessness there, absolutely. Some lexical items, the way he pronounced Belleville might be unique to his area.
But we don't hear that classic New York accent of the old days in the old movies where people said Toyd Street.
No, and in fact, what's very interesting is that some of those really stereotyped characteristics of New York City speech are really being lost over time, so that we're seeing change in the New York City dialect. So the toity-toid and toid, it's almost impossible to hear unless you're listening to a very old speaker. Younger speakers are not doing this.
And some people have told me that a Brooklyn accent is actually now a New Jersey accent.
Well, really, a Brooklyn accent, or the concept of Brooklynese or something like that, is a way that it's a word that people use, and really as a way to understand what they're perceiving us as social class differences, I think, so that if now they think that New Jersey is where the, you know, more lower class people are, the bridge and tunnel people are coming in with their awful ways of speaking, like these judgments that Natalie was talking about, well, then that's going to shift. And so you'll talk about a New Jersey ease or something like that.
Well, Natalie, are we moving toward a unified sound, or are we holding on to our regional accents? The reason I ask is Mario Batali, the chef, told me a joke the other day. He said, 100 years from now, someone's going to look at a piece of sheet music and be totally confused because he'll read out the lyric, "You say tomato, and I say tomato."
Yeah, that's a very, very, very interesting question, because, yes, you would think nowadays, you know, there's more intercommunication, everybody goes everywhere, everybody's mobile, there's internet, there's this, that, and the other. But actually, research indicates that, no, indeed, we are not, accents and dialects are not leveling out in the U.S., and in fact, the major dialects of the U.S. are actually getting more different from one another.
Are there theories?
More similar. Theories as to why?
Yes. We hear different accents within the same family, but we're talking about something else here. There seems to be all this pressure to sound alike, and our schools try to teach us to sound alike. And yet we hold on tenaciously, I guess is the word, to our regional accents.
Right. Yep. That's largely because, that the way we speak has so much to do with our sense of identity, our individual identity, and particularly our group identity. And I think that as we all do come into more and more contact with each other, things get homogenized, you know, globalized, everything starts looking and feeling the same stores, and everywhere you go, all across the country, that kind of thing. It's almost a threat to our regional and localized identity, and it's almost like maybe we're pushing back a little bit and asserting, you know, no, I am from New York City, no, I am from the South, no, I am from the North, I am from New England, that sort of thing, and maintaining and even strengthening these dialect boundaries.
There was a study at George Mason University in which they asked people to read a script, and we have two, one from someone from Brooklyn, and the other is from Atlanta.
Please call Stella. Ask her to bring those things with her from the store. 6 spoons of fresh snow peas, 5 thick slabs of blue cheese, and maybe a snack for her brother Bob. We also need a small plastic snake and a big toy frog for the kids.
Please call Stella. Ask her to bring these things with her from the store. 6 spoons of fresh snow peas, 5 thick slabs of blue cheese, and maybe a snack for her brother Bob. We also need a small plastic snake, a big toy frog for the kids.
And I don't think anyone listening to that would have trouble figuring out where those people came from.
I don't think so at all. I would agree with Natalie so much about the importance of identity, and agree with the idea of a pushback in terms of keeping our regional accents. And I would also point out that fear that globalization is somehow going to level our ways of talking so that we all speak alike. The linguistic theory just disagrees with that, in the sense that really what matters to individual speakers when we learn to talk is our friends and our peers, so that we really end up speaking like the people we spend time with and not like who we hear on TV or something like that.
Well, Natalie, how does this apply to African-American vernacular? Because that African-Americans who move to the North often still sound like they are in the South.
Right, absolutely. And again, a lot of this does have to do with matters of identity, group identity, cultural identity, and maintaining your roots as well. You know, you come from, you know, you have a heritage, long-standing roots in the South, and you maintain and preserve that. And in addition, unfortunately, there are issues of, you know, long-standing historic segregation that can cement in place dialect differences. Even people living, you know, within the same city in different neighborhoods perhaps have very little interaction. So combination of interaction patterns and matters of cultural and personal feelings of identity.
I think that's absolutely true, in the sense that even in New York, we hear a lot of features that have carried through from the South and African-American speech. But at the same time, there's been a lot of new research, which is very exciting, which shows that African-Americans in all cities all across the U.S. that we expect to speak to sound exactly the same are, in fact, adopting some of these regional features. And that's a new thing that linguists are starting to find out. We used to think of it as a very homogenous variety. And, in fact, you know, in New York, for instance, you heard the Brooklyn woman saying that very frog pronunciation, the coffee vowel. We see African Americans pronouncing that, and that's an exciting finding, because it shows us that African Americans perhaps are moving away from that homogenous variety and starting to adopt local pronunciations.
We're talking about regional accents on today's Please Explain, and my guests are Kara Becker of the Linguistics Department of New York University and Natalie Schilling, Associate Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University. And we're going to take a little break and then come back with more and take your calls. So stay with us. And we're back with Please Explain, and my guest, Natalie Schilling, Associate Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University, and Kara Becker of the Linguistics Department of New York University. And our number here, if you'd like to join in this conversation, is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a message on our show page at WNYC.org. And I want to get to those calls as quickly as possible, but I just want to touch on a few other regional accents that I have been aware of. We have a number of people on NPR who report from the city they call Washington, and I assume that means that they come from Chicago. Is that likely?
I'm not sure. Maybe, Natalie, do you want to take that one? I don't think so.
Oh, gosh.
Washington. But just about, there is a Midwestern accent. I remember the first time I saw the Donahue Show and then later Oprah, and I was stunned by the accents of the people there, because I always thought the Midwest accent would have been a relatively regionless accent.
That's absolutely true. I think that... But actually, what you're referring to is an area that's a little farther south, an area that dialectologists would call the Midlands accent. So maybe areas of, say, Kansas or parts of Illinois, things like that, Missouri. What's happening around in cities like Chicago, Detroit, cities that surround the Great Lakes, is actually a very interesting sound change that we would call the Northern City Shift, so that you're getting a whole change in the vowel system, and pronunciations like Chicago as Chicago or something like that. And what's happening is that all the vowels in these folks' systems are being pronounced very differently.
Now, what happens on the West Coast? Because the West Coast is an area where people from all over the country have converged. Is it more likely that you'll hear an accentless approach there, or do we just hear a melting pot of approaches?
It's certainly more likely. There's a few interesting things happening. One is a merger of two vowels that, for instance, in New York, we keep separate. So I say I slept on a cot, but I also caught the ball, right? In the West Coast, these two vowels are merged so that you sleep on a cot and you caught the ball. Mm-hmm. And in most places of the West...
They say water.
Right. So there's a little more homogeneity there. At the same time, there are certain things that are starting to emerge in terms of sound changes and unique things that define countries like, or I'm sorry, states like California.
One way you can always tell whether someone is from the East Coast or the rest of the country is the way they pronounce the word orange or orange. Nevada, Nevada, Florida, Florida. And this has always been the case. Natalie, do we know why? I mean, 90% of the country pronounces it orange and foreigner. And there's this holdout in the East Coast where we say foreigner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the East Coast, of course, English. There have been English speakers in settlements in the East Coast a lot longer than in the West. And so the dialect differentiation in the East Coast is greater. We have, I guess, stronger dialects, more differentiated dialects. And then as we move westward, as Kara was saying, we do get a bit more homogeneity. Previous times maybe more homogeneity, but very interestingly, I was mentioning that while regional dialects, at least large regional dialects, are not going away and maybe even getting more distinct from one another, and we've also found, for example, in the West Coast that new dialects can even arise, even nowadays in this day and age. So when Kara was mentioning interesting things going on in California. So, for example, we can even nowadays talk about California Englishes or different varieties within California that are newer.
North and South, I assume.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and, of course, right. L.A. has a very strong Mexican influence and also a very strong Asian influence. So
right.
I'm sure things are constantly changing. Let's take some calls. Carmelia from the Bronx. Hi.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I have two questions that I think have to do with the Irish. One is I was once in New Orleans, and I swear I had a ride from a cab driver who had a New York accent. I'm thinking maybe there was like some little Irish population there or something. And then the second question is all these American accents that supposedly have been influenced by the Irish, they don't sound to me at all like modern Irish accents, or at least the ones I heard when I went to Ireland. So enlighten me, please.
I could take the first question, unless, Natalie, you want to.
No, go ahead.
What we think happened in New Orleans, and it's true that there are a lot of folks there who actually sound very much like New Yorkers, and it seems so strange because they're cities that are so far apart. What we think happened is that there was a certain period of time when trade between the two cities was very strong before we had land trade. We were going through down around the ocean and trading between New York and New Orleans. And so we think that the contact between those two cities was strong enough that features from New York actually remained in New Orleans, so that you actually do hear a lot of the similar features spoken in New Orleans. It's very interesting.
That toity-toity thing.
Absolutely. And it didn't happen just in New Orleans, but actually there's been research showing that New York features diffused to a number of other cities due to trade and due to contact because of that.
And do you want to answer the other question, Natalie?
Sure, yeah. So we do talk about a lot of influence from Irish settlement, from Scots Irish settlement in the U.S. And, okay, well, how come we don't sound like today's Irish? Well, the answer is that all dialects change over time. So Irish English hasn't remained unchanged since, you know, the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, just as American English hasn't remained unchanged over the centuries. And so that's the reason that there might still be, you know, some similarities, some remnants that we do share alike, for example, pronouncing our R's rather than not pronouncing them, maybe certain lexical items. I don't know if anybody still says shenanigans or something like that. but dialects and accents are always changing on both sides of the Atlantic.
A listener wonders how influential the French Creole culture is on the accent in New Orleans.
They're fairly distinct. I think what the previous listener was asking was about native English speakers who are using their native regional dialect, and that is influenced or was influenced in the past by New York. Creole speakers are kind of the descendants of Acadian French that came down from Canada, settled in New Orleans, and they created kind of a mixed language which included French and English. So it's something a little bit separate. Of course, there's going to be bleed over in between the two sort of ways of pronunciation.
We go now to Corey from the Washington Heights, Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air, Corey.
Hi there. I'm actually a lapsed MIT linguist. I'm a neurobiologist.
Uh-oh.
but you, I have a comment about what you're noticing about black dialects beginning to assimilate to the sort of local regional dialects. And my sense is actually this is not something new. I remember years ago when people were studying this, they tend to focus on young people with very strong urban dialects. But I look at my older relatives, and they sound quite different. In fact, my great aunt, who's about 84, who lived her whole life in Brooklyn, sounds like an older Jewish woman. And so I think part of it may have been the focus on which part of the black population, because many of the older people have assimilated and have assimilated for a long time into the local regional dialects.
Another listener along these lines has written in wondering about the impact of a parent's accent as being more or less important than the region and area that a person lives in.
That's an easier question to answer, I think, which is that normally the peers or the friends are more important than a parent's accent. So depending on the age, say if you moved from another area to New York, for instance, and your parents are from Chicago, it's more likely for you to adopt a New York accent if you came at a fairly young age. To go back to the call-in question, I think he's absolutely right. There were a couple things that happened. First is probably that there was more regional variation that we were than we knew about as linguists than we're studying at the time. And part of that was that even to this day, there unfortunately is still a resistance to accepting that African-American English is a sort of legitimate, distinct, systematic variety. And so what we were doing as linguists was really looking for the commonalities, because what we wanted to do is show, well, look, this is absolutely a systematic variety. Look at all the things that these speakers share. And it hasn't been until more recently that we've started to look for the differences between these varieties. So I think they have existed. It's just that now we're focusing on them a little bit more.
I would actually recommend, if people are looking for a fertile place to study this, go to Crown Heights.
Yeah,
there you have
great.
An interesting population of West Indian blacks and Orthodox and Hasidic Jews. And you find, although there's not a lot of interaction between the populations, they tend to pass to like oil and water, the speech has shared features.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's absolutely happening in New York. And when I look at older African Americans that I've studied in New York, they absolutely have New York City English features. So
we go now to Judith from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I want to confirm about Warsh, because my Iowa grandmother always said she was going to do the Warsh. but I grew up in suburban Detroit, just across the river from Canada. And I've lived here a long time. I've tried to get rid of things like Dow and Aunt. But one thing I can't get rid of is out.
About.
I can hear myself do it, but I cannot correct it.
And we associate that with Canada, but it's obviously something that you hear from all of the border states, people from Minnesota also.
And in Maine and in parts of New England that border Canada.
Is it a Scottish origin sort of thing?
Do you think that's Scottish?
I'm not sure. Do you know, Natalie?
No. Actually, it's hard to say exactly where that comes from, but it actually, interestingly enough, in older forms of English, Middle English, that was actually the original, an earlier pronunciation of ow, and has resurfaced in areas like Canada. It's actually more of an independent development in different areas, in different Englishes. It's a common thing to do with that sound, and so we do find it in Canada, we do find it in border states, and we also find it, for example, in even areas removed from that in the U.S., so the Tidewater, Virginia area, for example, has a similar out-and-about type sound, and it's very difficult to get, if you are trying to eliminate regionality or regional markers from your speech, it's very difficult to eliminate certain pronunciation features. They really tend to get established early and really ingrained in your languages, so it can be quite tough.
And that's why Henry Kissinger can still not pronounce the W, even though he arrived when he was in his early teens.
Sure.
Yeah, difficult to get rid of a non-native accent as well. Yeah.
On the other hand, aren't new accents being developed? For example, the Valley Girl accent in California?
Sure. The Valley Girl accent, I think, is interesting because it started not as an accent, but probably more as the use of slang and a few other features like intonation, so that really rising pitch or the pitch range. But it's probably advanced into other things like pronunciation, so that you see in Southern California and other parts of California, the fronting of a vowel like O or U, so you get shoes or I do or something like that. So it's advanced, and it's absolutely a developing dialect.
My guests are Kara Becker of NYU and Natalie Schilling of Georgetown. Natalie, do isolated populations and rural communities tend to develop distinct accents? You've studied the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Is that accent really different from the mainland North Carolina accent?
Yes, it is very different. And so that if you spend, decades, centuries even, in historic isolation from mainland dialects, and a lot of times people go there and they think, oh, this is Old English, this is Elizabethan English or Shakespearean English. But again, it's independent developments, the developments that take place over time as you're out there 20 miles from the mainland.
We have a clip. You want to listen?
Oh, absolutely.
I was born and raised right here in Mandia. And I grew up here, and I went to school with local children and on the island, and I graduated, and we all talk alike. But the bridge going over to Nag's Head was there, and of course we went back and forth. But when I went to school, the children from across the sign had to come across every morning on the ferry.
Wow. Not one sound similar to the way a New Yorker would have said those words.
Maybe the consonants.
and that is unique to that area?
It's pretty strongly confined to that area. That we can find some similar features maybe in some other island dialects up and down the coast. I've done some work in Smith Island, Maryland, in the Chesapeake Bay. We find some similar features. So dialects do mix and match features. It's not that any one dialect has only features unique to itself, because we are one shared language. But it is very distinctive from the mainland, yeah.
A caller wants to know about certain other kinds of sounds. For example, when you say what, or you say what, or you say news, or you say news,
sure.
Are those very regional?
The what, the use of that sort of what we would call aspirated or giving a breath of air at the end of the WH sound, I don't think it's very regional. I think it's actually just an older feature, and that there was variation so that you could say what or what, probably associated maybe with status, so that if you were have higher status, you would make sure to say what and wheat and things like that. It's really being lost, actually, I think, not regionally or cross-regionally in the U.S., so that again, it would be rare to find a speaker who is pronouncing all those WHs in that fashion.
Other than me, and I definitely am of a low status. I don't know.
So you're keeping it going.
Well, maybe there's a radio announcer English as well.
It could be.
Should we take some more calls? Who do we want to go to next? Let's go to Cynthia from Yonkers. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, I'm Cynthia, and I describe myself as Yankee-born and Southern-bred. I'm a teacher at a linguistic school, International Language School, EF, and many of my students, I'm African-American, and many of my students in quiet times will approach me and ask, how can I tell the difference between a wealthy black person and a poor black person? Because very often status in Scandinavian countries and with the Asian students, they want to know more about class than anything else about the American class system, once they realize we have a class system. And what are your thoughts about that? How do you describe class differences and language among blacks and whites in this country?
Now, you use the word, you say often.
Yes. Well, I'm one of the few African-American instructors. And in the corridors or on campus, they'll sort of, walk up beside me and have a little conversation about music and about food. What's soul food really like? Or what is jazz really? And then once they become a bit more comfortable or less shy, they'll say, well, are you a New Yorker? And then, of course, I do the Yankee-born, Southern-bred, and they'll ask, Well, I've met some New Yorkers. They'll meet them at the clubs, and the clubs of the Marquee and other such places. And they want to know, well, how will I know the difference? How do I know to whom I'm speaking?
Well, and that is really what this whole thing is about, isn't it? That we judge people so much instinctively by their accents.
I think so, and I'm not sure it's necessarily always relates back to ethnicity, so that within any ethnic group, we're going to see a lot of differentiation according to socioeconomic class. And as you said, we don't always like to acknowledge that that is something that exists in the U.S., and of course it does. And what's interesting in our linguistic research is we see such strong correlations between someone's sort of status in a society and the way they use specifically regional accent features, so that that if you are more working class, if you are of a lower class, you're much more likely to sound like where you're from. Because people who are of a higher status, who are upwardly mobile, there was the caller before who talked about working to lose certain things that she said. So if you're upwardly mobile, you're very motivated to lose your regional accent. So there's correlations there.
And we have another caller who worked to lose his accent. Paul from the Upper West Side. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Leonard. How are you? Yeah, I'm living proof that it really children are the ones that are going to pick it up first. And parents, you can take a 35-year-old that's set. They're just not going to pick up regional accents. I grew up in Brooklyn talking like this. Say, what's the matter with you? Hey, you coming out? You eating? No, you? I had it heavy. And then when we moved to New England, I got a job on a radio station at the age of 14. And the program director said, oh, well, you got to work on your R's. I go, yeah, oh, what's the matter with you? I got an R right here. Right? He goes, no, R. And after 2 or 3 years, I actually picked up the New Hampshire dialect. Don't you know? Hey, we're going to have a party tonight. And my parents were going crazy. And then we moved back to New York, and here it is. I'm back here again, and I find any other accent. It's just a matter of time. I don't think it would happen to me again. I'm 46 now, and I have a feeling that my accent is locked in tight. So it's your formative years, and your surroundings are definitely part of what makes you speak and how you speak. And by the way, anyone who says the word "warsh" still uses an outhouse. Sorry.
Thank you for calling us, Paul. But Natalie, there is a certain chameleon aspect to some people. We see it with actors, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. While I was just saying that it is hard to change some really core features of the dialect that you grew up with. It is indeed true that your dialect is cemented in your form, or is laid down in place in your formative years, but there is room for change, and there are people who, for various reasons, are more likely to adopt change. Maybe you move move from New York City to the South, and you fall in love with the South, and then 2 years later you sound like you're a native Southern speaker. Maybe you move to the South, you live there for 30 years, you still sound like a New Yorker, and you don't have as much sense of identity with the South. So these issues of identity and who you identify with come into play, whether you're going to keep your native dialect, whether you're going to adopt a new one, how adaptable you are. And right, of course, and then there are people who just simply have, greater ability to play with different voices. For example, people who are professional actors who are used to putting on all kinds of different personalities.
Joe Namath, who grew up in Pennsylvania but went to school in Alabama, has a Southern accent. I want to thank the both of you so much for participating in today's Please Explain, Looking at Regional Accents. Natalie Schilling is Associate Professor of Linguistics at Georgetown University. Carr Becker is from the Linguistics Department of New York University. It's been a lot of fun.
It has. Thank you so
much.
And
we want to also thank the George Mason University Speech Accent Archive for supplying us with those clips that we played of international dialects in the English database. You can find links to those archives on our show page at wnyc.org.